Well, on very rare occasion, we have opportunity here on Issues Etc. to talk with someone who's close to the halls of power. Our guest here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from the LCMS World Relief Conference on Mercy here in St. Louis is Tim Gagelein, Special Assistant to the President of the United States and Deputy Director of the Office of Public Liaison there at the White House. In the second half hour of the program, Pastor David Chuchu will join us along with Dr. Danny Oyehu and Sally Henriksen. We'll be talking about medical mercy in Kenya. And then in about the third half hour, starting our second hour of the program, Dr. Richard Iyer, author of our Issues Etc., Book of the Month for April, Marriages Like Dancing, will be our guest. Right after that, a conversation with Dr. Beverly Yonke, a regular guest. We'll talk about mercy and suffering. She's director of Christian Counseling Services in Milwaukee. A little later then in the program, Pastor Glenn Merritt will join us. We'll be talking about response to natural and man-made disasters. He's in charge of disaster response for LCMS World Relief. As I said, we're broadcasting live this Monday from the LCMS World Relief Conference on Mercy here in St. Louis. I'm Todd Wilkin. You can join us with your questions and your comments. Our call-in numbers, as usual, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Joining us here in our makeshift studio at the Airport Marriott in St. Louis, Tim Gagelein. He's been on the program before. We're going to have a conversation with this assistant to President Bush. He's also deputy director of the Office of Public Liaison. Tim, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Todd, thank you so much. It's nice to be on. Nice to be back.
What is it President Bush really like? Every president has kind of a public persona that people have access to through the media. It's positive, it's negative. What is the man really like?
Well, I'm very happy to say that having worked almost 20 years in Washington, which is a fancy way of saying I've spent a lot of time around politicians, I can tell you that George W. Bush is a rare politician in that he is the same in private as he is in public. He is a very witty, a very funny guy. He's fun to be with. He's a family man. He and the First Lady are very, very close. They have a close family. But I would say at the heart of the matter, he is a very strong Christian, a man of conviction and faith, and it really informs so much of his friendships and relationships otherwise, Todd.
I want to hear the White House's basic kind of reaction, what's the scuttlebutt in the White House, on two very recent events. The first one was the Supreme Court decision just about 2 weeks ago to uphold the ban on partial birth abortion. What was the White House's general reaction to this and the president's in particular?
Well, the president put a statement out immediately after the ruling, and the president, needless to say, was very pleased. The president has been the most pro-life president in American history. In fact, before he was president of the United States, the president gave a number of important speeches saying that he thought that every person should be welcomed into the world and protected by the law. And when he was asked what that meant, practically in politics, practically in public policy, he said that when it came the time for him, if president, he would nominate and hope to have confirmed to the High Court men of the caliber of Justice Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, i.e., men who read the Constitution and did not feel it was their job to interpret the Constitution, but that it was their job to uphold the laws that had been passed by other people. And the president, as I say, has spoken at length about the value and the culture of life, and that every person who was ever born mattered. And so when the court, 5-4, said that the ban on partial birth abortion was constitutional, i.e., Congress was correct when it outlawed what Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the former Democratic senator from New York, said a form of infanticide, the president agreed. He felt it was a form of infanticide, and he was pleased that Justice Alito, who is one of the two men that the president has appointed to the court, disagreed with the former justice, Sandra Day O'Connor, who had retired, and the president was pleased that by one vote, the ban on partial birth abortion was upheld.
Was he surprised?
He was not surprised because the president, unlike his predecessor, Bill Clinton, had not vetoed the ban on partial birth abortion. And I think this is very important to remember. Not once but twice during the Clinton administration, former President Clinton vetoed a ban. He said that a ban was the wrong thing. And George W. Bush several times said that he felt that in that regard, Bill Clinton was wrong, that the ban was justified. And certainly, because every president does his best to nominate men and women to the court who they feel comes closest to their view of the Constitution, the president felt this was the right policy. Also, Todd, earlier, before the court ruling, the president, when he signed the ban on partial birth abortion, made it very clear when he signed the ban that we expected to fight this in four circuit courts, which we did, and that when he nominated a man or woman to the Supreme Court, he felt that this was an issue that was worthy of an upholding of the ban. And so in that regard, we could not have been more pleased, and it was a great day for all of us who believe that innocent preborn life deserves that protection.
A piece of legislation that was a little more expected, perhaps by many, was the Senate's final vote to expand funding for embryonic stem cell research.
Yes.
And the president very strongly sent the signal that he was going to veto that. Has he vetoed it yet? And what was the reaction at the White House when that federal funding that he limited in August of 2001 was, at least an attempt was made to expand it by the Senate?
I'm really glad you asked this question, and particularly on the heels of the partial birth abortion ruling, because although they're not related, they are both within the 30-yard lines of pro-life legislation. Two things are important to remember. One is that there has been no president in American history who has more consistently supported stem cell research, federal funding of stem cell research, than George W. Bush. But the critical distinction is that the president does not believe that we should should fund any research, i.e., any taxpayer dollar should be used to fund the destruction of embryonic human life. And so the president, while supporting stem cell research, does not support the federal funding of embryonic stem cell research because he believes an embryo is a human being. The president has not yet vetoed the embryonic stem cell bill. We're waiting for both houses to pass it. The president is expected to veto it. He has said and promised that he will veto it. But he wants to make sure that he does so if it comes his direction in a way that is consistent with his pro-life views.
So where does the legislation sit right now? Is it in conference?
It has passed the House.
Okay.
The new version has passed the House. We expect the House version to be adopted by the Senate and to be passed in the Senate sometime before the congressional August recess.
And will he veto it immediately? Will it simply, as soon as he gets his hands on it?
Yeah, I think that the president will. He is, in the history of the Bush administration, he has only vetoed one bill. It was a former embryonic stem cell research bill, and he did so pretty quickly on the heels of receiving it from Congress.
We're talking to Tim Gagelein. He's Special Assistant to the President of the United States and Deputy Director of the Office of Public Liaison at White House. We're having a conversation about various matters impacting America and the President administration. If you have a question or a comment for Tim Gagelein, you can give us a call. We're broadcasting live from the LCMS World Relief Conference on Mercy here in St. Louis, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us. We get your email right here at the Airport Marriott, issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Todd, I wonder if I may raise one issue, because
yeah,
I think it's so important. Although I live in Washington, D.C., I listen to KFUO.
Oh, good.
And I have to tell you, I have three favorite radio stations, because when I was a boy, I actually worked in radio, and I love the whole concept of radio and radio stations. KFUO is my favorite, and I think your remarkable commitment to classical music, to opera, and to the best of really thinking and the original best kind of talk radio in programs just like yours really means a lot. And I just wanted to say, for all of us who live beyond Missouri and St. Louis, but who have other means of listening to you. I just want you to know how much we appreciate the remarkable talk radio that you have. This is the kind of dialogue that is really such a great public service to all of us who love and revere KFUO, and your commitment, historic commitment, to classical music and to opera and the fine arts really means a lot, and especially to the rising generation of young people.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate those comments. They mean a lot coming from you. One other question on the veto, the president's prospective veto for the funding on embryonic stem cell research. Do you expect that veto to be upheld?
Yes, I do. I feel very confident about this. In fact, I do not believe that there are enough votes in the Congress supporting destructive embryonic stem cell research. In other words, I believe that most members in the House and Senate, they may have a majority, but they do not have a veto-proof majority. And I think just as in the first time, the president's policy will be sustained.
One of the moral issues that many voters are concerned about when it comes to President Bush has to do with gay marriage. While he
has
a very definite stated position as marriage is a man and a woman, some feel that he has not used enough of his political capital, pushing for perhaps a marriage amendment or something like that as a solution to this growing problem.
Right. I'm glad you asked that, because this is an issue that unfortunately, because of last night's and today's headlines, doesn't seem to get or garner the attention that it should. And in fact, Todd, the president has supported and continues to strongly support an amendment to the federal Constitution banning homosexual marriage. The president believes that marriage is a sacred institution between one man and one woman. He believes that it is the best institution by which to raise and to mold healthy children. And he also believes that the family, the traditional family, has so many competing claims now on its times and purpose that it's important to see what he called it, which is the unseen pillar of civilization. That's what he believes about the family.
Why are the president's poll numbers so low?
Because I think in part the war is unpopular, and wars are unpopular. They're unpopular if it's the Civil War. They're unpopular if it's World War I. They're unpopular if it's World War II. They're unpopular if it's the Korean War, and they're unpopular if it's the Cold War.
Has the war and its progress kept the president from doing things politically, legislatively, that he could have done if we had not gone to war in Iraq?
The answer is that you cannot know. History can only judge that. When you are a war president, you realize that the first constitutional obligation that you have as president of the United States is the security and the sovereignty of the country. And so as president, you invest an enormous amount of your time in victory. And I think this goes to the question that you asked a moment ago. You know, the president's popularity, may not be 90%, it may not be 80%. I've worked for him when it was that high, and I've worked for him when it's at this point. The good thing about George W. Bush is he does not sort of root his purpose as president in popularity polls. He roots them in the fundamental obligations of the Constitution, and it's to keep us safe.
While many of our listeners are divided on the issue of support for the war in Iraq or not, one of the things that our listeners are concerned about is what appears to be the president's naivete regarding the nature and the history of Islam as a part of the entire Middle East conflict, and in particular, terrorist activities in the world. Your thoughts there?
Yeah. Well, let me just say, George W. Bush has his critics. That is certainly true. But I would not put naivete about the fundamental nature of jihadism at the top. In fact, I would say that the president's biggest critics on the other side of the aisle say just the opposite. They do not agree with the president that the greatest threats to our way of life and our national security, to the constitutional proposition of America, is the combination of jihadism and nuclear proliferation. And that's what President Bush believes about our time, that if there is any fundamental threat to our country, it is that combination of Islamic radicalism and nuclear proliferation that genuinely, ultimately define the first part of the 21st century.
Well, I think what concerns them is the religion of Islam as the fuel of jihadism, or perhaps the failure to distinguish or the failure to see the connection between jihadism and Islam as a religion.
Yeah, I think that that's a temptation that people think that perhaps the president doesn't realize or know. But in fact, as president, he realizes that the greatest threats to the country, in fact, are those cultural questions that you raise, which can become ultimately theological questions as well. They impinge directly on our national way of life. And in fact, it's something that as president you have to be aware of and concerned for all the time.
He used the term Islamic fascists some time back, and many of our listeners reacted favorably to this, saying, okay, it seems as though President Bush is starting to understand that Islam plays a role in jihadism, as you said.
Right.
But I haven't heard him use that term in a long time.
You know, it's interesting. The president has given a number of speeches, news conferences, et cetera, where he talks at length about people who pervert religion, about people who are zealots in exactly the wrong way, and has talked at length about the nature of the enemy. And I think ultimately, Todd, if we had to sort of think about the early part of the 21st century, I think it would be less the difference between Republicans and Democrats or liberals and conservatives versus people who believe that jihadism and nuclear proliferation versus those who don't is in fact the greatest threat to America's sovereignty and in the new century, the kind of country that we will leave to our children and our grandchildren.
I wanted to spend a few minutes with you talking about the prospective candidates for 2008. If the vote were held
I'm officially agnostic.
Oh, really? Really? Would you be willing to say who you'd vote for if the elections were held today?
Well, because the Constitution limits me to voting for my favorite president only twice, probably not. It's not that I don't want to answer questions. It's that morally, legally, ethically, it's probably best if I not comment specifically on each candidacy. But I'm happy to talk generally.
Well, generally, what do you make of the Republican candidates for 2008 as it's comprised right now? Still a long ways off.
Generally, what I would say is this. I think that the issues that will carry forth into the 2008 election, and if I can be so bold to say the 2012 election, are already antecedents in the Bush administration. That is to say, the largest questions that face America now will be the ones that face us in 2008. And I believe very firmly that any candidate on either side of the political aisle which does not address some of the issues that we've been talking about in a fair and in an honest way do not deserve to be president of the United States. In other words, I think it is impossible to run for the presidency and to say that you're going to pull us out of Iraq because the enemy will follow us home. I think it's impossible to run for the presidency and to say that that the regard for the culture of life is not the one that we should be pursuing, that the issues of judges in the Supreme Court should not ultimately be rooted in our Federalist way of life and the interpretation that our founders intended for us. I mean, I think these are really big, important, and central issues. I think the president is right. I think jihadism and nuclear proliferation really are the greatest threats to our country and our culture. I think the president is right that you have to have constitutionalist judges who are not judges who sort of rule as closet legislators. And I think that the issue of having appointed now 34% of all sitting federal judges is a huge accomplishment.
What about the Democratic candidates for president in 2008, very briefly?
I have to say, having listened now very intently to three of them, to be unnamed, but I think people can guess who they are, it's very disturbing that, in fact, some people who were previously for the war now seem to be against it. People actually voting for the war and then saying they're against it. I think that that's a path to defeatism. And even if people may not be comfortable with being in Iraq, I certainly don't think they want us to pull back and to lose.
One of the things that was in the news a lot with David Kuo's book, about a year ago, when he came out of the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, he was talking about what was going on there. what we noticed with our listeners is faith-based initiatives had absolutely no traction with them. They seemed to show no interest for it, and yet it is probably one of the president's initial highest priorities when he was coming into his presidency.
Right.
What's going
right.
on here?
Well, it's interesting. David said in that book, and he is a former colleague and remains a friend, but David said in this book that the president would give I'm doing a rhetorical thing here, sort of give kudos and smiles to religious conservatives, but didn't really give them any policy successes, which I think is rather extraordinary. This is a president, as I say, who has nominated and confirmed 34% of all sitting federal judges, including two Supreme Court justices. This is a president who pulled us out of the EVM Treaty, pulled us out of the Kyoto Treaty, pulled us out of the International Criminal Court. It's a president who has provided seven major tax cuts and doubled the child tax credit. As I say, he's the most pro-life president in American history. I think that those are real and substantial and, frankly, huge accomplishments. With regard to the faith-based initiative, it is absolutely true that the Democrats succeeded in defeating a significant portion of the president's faith-based initiative. And their view was rooted in one principle, which is that religious institutions should not have categorical abilities to hire and fire according to the dictates of the religious or faith-based institution. And that is an issue upon which we just sincerely disagreed in principle. We think that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod or Catholic Charities or et cetera, should be able to hire and fire according to the lights of what that faith-based organization believes, whether they are taking federal funding or not.
With only a minute here, is the president a lame duck?
No president is a lame duck. And I believe that that is perhaps the most overstated, unconventional, or depending on how you view it, conventional view. I think into the last hour or the last minute of the last day of an administration, a president who can set major foreign and domestic policy is not a lame duck, and there's still a lot to do.
What's the legacy? You mentioned a few things just a moment ago, but what in a nutshell is the legacy of two terms of President George W. Bush? You got about 45 seconds.
You bet. In a nutshell, it's this. The president's father served at the ending of something big, the end of the Cold War, and his son, George W. Bush, serves at the beginning of something big, which is the combination, as we've said a couple of times, of jihadism and nuclear proliferation, which in the 21st century will be the greatest threats to our country, our culture, and our civilization. That is a huge legacy. And historians who are, in my view, a very objective bunch when they're doing their best work, will determine whether that was exactly the right decision by the president or whether it was not. And I believe history will be very kind to George W. Bush, who is already a president of consequence.
Tim Gagline is special assistant to the President of the United States. He's deputy director of the Office of Public Liaison at the White House. Tim, thank you very much for coming over, and Godspeed on your travels back
thank
to Washington,
you so much.
D.C.
Thank you, Todd.
Thank you.
A real pleasure.
And for your kind words about KFUO.
It's a wonderful station. Every blessing to you and all the good people who work there and who listen.
Thank you very much. When we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time with a round table. Our table is not round, and our table is very small. So somehow we're going to be able to fit in Pastor David Chu-Chu and Dr. Oyeho and Sally Henriksen around our table for a conversation on medical mercy trips to Kenya. In fact, it wasn't too long ago that Sally was at our microphones when she returned from a nursing trip there. We'll talk about all of that after this.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Christians and Christian publishing spend a lot of time talking about marriage. How does God define marriage? After all, marriage is God's gift. Is marriage whatever we want it to be or whatever we need it to be? What is God's ultimate purpose for marriage? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for April is called Marriage is Like Dancing. It's written by Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Richard Iyer. Marriage is Like Dancing is $14.99 plus shipping and handling. You can find the book at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about Marriage is Like Dancing. It's the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Discover what God's gift of marriage is really all about with our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April by Dr. Richard Iyer, Marriage is Like Dancing.
Are pro-life advocates responsible for increasing abortions? Hillary Clinton is making that charge.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Believe it or not, New York Senator Hillary Clinton is claiming that pro-life lawmakers should be held responsible for abortions because many oppose government funding of contraception. In a fundraising letter to supporters, Clinton charges that anyone who opposes mandating coverage for contraception in insurance plans or allowing sales of the morning after pill must not truly want to reduce the number of abortions. It's hard to believe most Americans would buy that argument, and it's further proof that pro-abortion politicians are running out of talking points to support their cause.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Many who went to church yesterday heard the words of Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. The text rushes on, but stop and think about the sweep of that statement. I do want peace in my relationships. Why do work and family always get hung up on personal conflict? I do want some health. What health need are you praying for? I do want a bit of money. Wouldn't you like to sleep knowing you're financially secure? I do want my loved one back. Death has come to our home, and I am not content. I do want someone to end my loneliness. I do want. It's a psalm of pronouns, this 23rd psalm. After I shall not want come numerous references to the Good Shepherd, to the things he does for me. He gives me peace. He guides me into righteousness. Then the psalm shifts to more personal address, to the things you do for me. You are with me in times of fear. You vindicate my trust in you. Your goodness and love are with me. I will be with you forever. I shall not want. The only way that audacious claim of faith can be made is to let yourself be held close to the heart of your Good Shepherd. I'm Dale Meyer.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin here in the second half hour of the program as we come to you live this Monday, the 30th of April, from the LCMS Conference on Mercy here in St. Louis. We're going to be talking with a round table of guests. Sally Henriksen is a regular guest on the program. She's a registered nurse and material and medical goods resource coordinator for LCMS World Relief. And we're joined also by Dr. Dayden Oyeho, who's a medical doctor in Kenya, and Pastor David Chuchu, who's project director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya. We're going to talk about medical mercy in Kenya. You can join us. Our phone numbers are the same, whether we're here at the Airport Marriott or whether we're in the studios at KFUO, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Coming up in 25 minutes, we'll be talking with Dr. Richard Iyer, author of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for April, Marriage is Like Dancing, on the very last day of April. We'll talk about marriage, parenting, and growing old together. Coming up in about an hour from now, Dr. Beverly Yonke will join us. We'll be talking about mercy and suffering. And then a little later in the program, Pastor Glenn Merritt of LCMS World Relief, he's their disaster response director. We'll talk about man-made and natural disasters and how we Christians respond. Again, our phone number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Sally Henriksen, welcome back to Issues Etc. And Sally's brought with her also Dr. Dayton Oyeho, who's a medical doctor in Kenya. Doctor, welcome to you.
Welcome. Thank you.
And Pastor David Chuchu, who is project director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya. Welcome to you, Pastor.
Thank you.
Sally, begin with you. You recently were in Kenya for a medical mercy trip. What were the needs that you saw there, and what were you able to accomplish?
Well, we've just started this program, and our first trip was back in October, was our pilot trip, and now this has been a second trip, and we have more scheduled up and coming, and really look forward to having the doctors join us. But this time we went to a couple of places we were not able to go previously. One was Dr. Oyeho's home area, where he's from, where they have no medical services. So we brought a team of about 13 doctors and nurses. One was a surgeon. Dr. Oyeho's a surgeon as well, so he was able to get us the opportunity to do surgery in his hospital there. So we did 7 general cases, 12 minor cases at another facility that's owned by the ELCK. And we saw, I haven't run all the numbers yet, but we saw probably about 1,500 people who would not have otherwise had any access to medical care.
And how long did you see 1,500 people?
A week.
Really?
We worked long hours.
When you say no medical services, explain that to me. What does that mean?
I think I'll let Dr. Oyeho answer this because he's the director of his hospital and has a better grasp on his country's health care.
Okay, so when Sally says no medical services in this kind of area, what does that mean, Dr. Oyeho?
Yeah, in Kenya, we have basically 3 kinds of health care service providers. We have the government of Kenya, we have the faith-based organization, and also we have the privately owned health facilities. You find that in Kenya, in the rural areas, the villages, you don't have the health facilities situated. So most of our health facilities are within the urban areas. So like my village, to reach the nearest health facility, you have to walk 4-5 miles away to access healthcare services. And the other problem in our healthcare system is that the government-owned facilities, we have the smallest unit we call dispensaries, but most of them are not equipped, and you lack the essential drugs and supplies. So most of the time, you go there and you don't get the service that you require. And the other issue about the cases that we are able to treat during the medical mission mercy trips are, we have very sick patients coming over, and some have not been able to be attended to because of lack or inability to afford the health care. So most of them will just stay with their ailments without seeking medical treatment because they cannot afford from the rural areas.
So the problem is really twofold. The problem is both the unavailability of many basic medical services, and even when they are available, they're often unaffordable by the people who need them most.
Yeah, that's true. Majority of people cannot afford.
Sally mentioned the surgeries that you were able to perform last time Sally was in Kenya. What kind of surgeries are we talking about, Dr. Oyeho?
Yeah, I'm a general surgeon, and during the visit by the team, we had quite a wide range of cases. We had children with inguinal hernias. We had children with umbilical hernias. We had adults with hydrocele, big, huge hydroceles that we were able to handle that day. And we also had adults with very huge inguinal hernias. So those are some of the cases that we were able to handle that particular day with the visiting surgeons.
And what is, as a nurse, what's doing surgery under those circumstances like, Sally? Can you describe it?
Very different. You have to be very flexible. And for those who are in the medical profession, take yourself back about 40 years. No electric cautery machines. All the vessels you clamp individually and tie off with sutures. In the U.S., that would be considered pretty much archaic. The day we were there, the hospital had problems. There was no water. So the nurses went and brought water in large drums to the hospital. So I scrubbed for 10 minutes, and then they poured this murky water over my hands. OSHA in the U.S. would have been very upset with us, but everybody got well, and nobody got infections over there.
Really?
Really.
Well, perhaps we have weaker constitutions because we have better, more advanced medical care, but I don't know which one I'd want to trade.
Well, actually, part of it is due to the fact that a lot of those people have not been exposed to antibiotics, so they do better, even though they're a lot sicker with less. The other thing is there was a limited number of instruments available, only one very small autoclave, no monitors, no blood pressure cuffs and things for recovery. Just in the operating room, so yeah, it was real different.
But it can be done, Dr. Oyeho. I mean, just because they don't have thoroughly modern or what we might expect in the West is the basic necessities of doing surgery, it can be done. It must be done.
Yeah, you know, we are faced with that dilemma because here you are a surgeon based in the rural setup, and you have a patient who has to be operated on, and you know, you have to do your best. And most of the time, we meet challenges during operations because there are cases that may require the intensive care monitoring, but you may not have. But we have to do what we have to do. And that's why we are actually struggling to be able to avail the necessary equipment and supplies.
Pastor Chuchu, it must be daunting to look at medical mercy trips like this that take place in Kenya and to realize, as you oversee all of these things for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya, that you are really only scratching the surface. You're only beginning to touch upon the real needs that are there. Talk about that, if you would, Pastor.
And thank you very much. I think we are so grateful for this initiative of the Mercy Medical Teams to Kenya. For the last two trips, one in October and the one held recently, close to 3,000 people have received access to health care that they would have not been able to receive if the teams were not there. Our primary focus has been on the very vulnerable people in Kenya, focusing mainly in the rural villages, which are far or remote areas far away from the cities. And people that live in those rural communities, mainly widows, orphans, and as we live in a community that many people have died as a result of HIV and AIDS, we are faced with these elderly people living with orphans, no access to health care. So the initiative of reaching them in the villages with the medical teams is a real hope to the hopeless that comes in our midst.
Pastor, would you talk a bit about HIV and AIDS as what is the scope of the problem there in Kenya and elsewhere in Africa?
HIV AIDS actually live with us in churches, and many people have died because of that HIV and AIDS. And as a result of that, there are a lot of stigma as well attached to HIV AIDS in our systems or in our communities or even in our churches. We are faced with that dilemma. I think some of this has come as a result of the cultural lives of the people, the behaviors of the people, and majority of our people get HIV/AIDS because of a heterosexual relationship. And as a result of that, we think it is the duty of the church as well to come out and speak on behavior change and also conduct awareness in the areas that we work in, so that we will also be able to address the pandemic. In so doing, we also come across people who are HIV positive, who need to receive ARVs, and part of the teams that have been coming, one of the doctors is an HIV/AIDS specialist, and we're working along with her to establish also church clinics to be able to offer ARVs to these people in our midst that do go through that kind of difficulties at the moment.
How, Dr. Oyeho, how is HIV/AIDS usually treated under the circumstances that you find there, given the fact that we were talking earlier about the lack of basic medical supplies?
Yeah, just before I answer that, I wanted just to add something on the short-term visits by the Mercy team. The other aspect that we have found to be quite useful to us is during the visits by these teams, we have been able, or the teams have been able to come up and assist us, not only by offering the treatment, but able to look for other resources. The last team that came from Texas, when they came over, they were able to identify a CAT scanner, which was not being used in their facility. And then they have been able to make arrangement to ship to us that facility. So I feel that will help to improve our services. Now, in HIV/AIDS, in our setup, HIV/AIDS in our setup is a big issue because the drugs are not available to all the patients that need the HIV, the antiretroviral drugs. So you find most of the times most patients have to be on waiting lists because the supplies are not adequate at any given time. So that is the biggest challenge we have. And then in the rural areas, talking about the laboratory workups, it becomes a bit difficult because we don't have we cannot be able to do most of the tests in the rural areas. So it is still quite a challenge to manage HIV in our setup.
Those waiting lists, what does it mean for someone who's suffering from HIV/AIDS if they're put on a waiting list just for the basic drugs that would not even necessarily treat it, but just abate the progress of the virus?
The waiting list means somebody will be put on just drugs for opportunistic infections as we wait for more supplies of drugs and antiretroviral to start. So most of the patients will be started when it's too late to help them much. So it makes management quite difficult because you start too late.
What did you see, Sally, in terms of the HIV crisis there? What did you see personally?
The one good thing that we had was that working with the church, that the church has voluntary counseling and testing sites. And on one of the trips, we were able to bring our own test kits to do a preliminary test. So the doctors were able to speak to the people. So you have the church speaking to the people from the pulpit of talking about AIDS and that, yes, it's in the church and a church problem to help with the stigma. And then you have the doctors coming and be able to offer preliminary tests that if shows they're positive, then we can refer them on so that they can better manage their lives and their symptoms with what resources they do have. So in one way, it was a very positive thing. And the other situations where we didn't have access to that, we mainly just treated what we saw without tests. You know, you strictly go by people's symptoms. And as big a problem as HIV is also malaria.
Right.
So we treated a lot of people for malaria. Every place we went, we wormed the entire community. Intestinal worms are a big problem because of sanitation and water issues. So we would go in, like in Samanga, where Dr. Ayeo is from, we went to a school because there's no clinic there. We set up on school desks and things. We had four doctors to a classroom, so there's no privacy or anything here. Can you imagine going to your doctor and be sitting there with four other people or maybe half a dozen kids with you? And they would do their intakes, and we'd check blood pressures, and then we'd prescribe medications, and we dispensed them there as well. But as everybody that was signed up by the church partners and finds volunteers to be translators, to register patients, and to help package up, everybody got vitamins, a month worth of vitamins, and they all got wormed. That's right off the top of the bat. So that's just one standard of care you're getting without even being seen by a doctor.
So then very quickly in those rural areas where, as Dr. Oyejo said, you don't even have the basic lab facilities to be able to properly test for HIV, you might be saying, okay, this person most likely has HIV from the symptoms they're presenting, and you're treating the symptoms. Is that what you're doing when you find someone with AIDS or who you think has AIDS in those rural areas?
In such cases, you'll not start on antiretroviral drugs. You'll have to send them to the nearest facilities where they can be able to be tested for HIV. So you'll just treat for any other symptoms that the patient may present with.
So they usually have HIV, among a lot of other things. So you're going to treat their malaria, their malnutrition, their anemia, their high blood pressure. We'll do those things, and then we'll refer them on for their HIV treatment. And that they would have to do through the government facility, because the ARVs, the antiretroviral medications, are a long-term treatment, and they have to be taken very specifically. And so the hospital tries to keep track of that, because if you're not, if you don't come back to get your medicine, then we know you're not compliant.
We're talking about medical mercy in Kenya. Pastor David Chuchu is one of our guests. He's project director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya. Also Dr. Dayden Oyeho, who's a medical doctor in Kenya, and Sally Henriksen, a regular guest and registered nurse. She's also materials and medical goods resource coordinator for LCMS World Relief. We're coming to you live this Monday, the 30th of April, broadcasting from the LCMS Conference on Mercy here in St. Louis. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, even as we broadcast remotely, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Chuchu, you said that part of dealing with HIV/AIDS is helping people understand that it is in the churches. Pastorally, how do you deal with the behavioral issues that go along, sometimes lead to infection with HIV/AIDS, and with people, I think Sally had mentioned the stigma, people having a stigma attached culturally or religiously to those who suffer from AIDS?
Behavior is a gradual process. It's quite difficult to change it in a day. But what we have done in our church, we have initiated a training that is focusing to church workers. We began by training our pastors on basic understanding of what HIV/AIDS is, and then we trained our evangelists and deaconesses. And the focus of our trainings has been to reduce the stigma so that we would know in the church what would be the relevant language that we could use towards the people living with HIV and AIDS. In the past, we have seen people, when you refer somebody that you received HIV/AIDS as being the greatest sinner, such languages have even made people not to come to church, because probably you were there with a widow who received HIV/AIDS probably from her husband, not from her own sin, and therefore it is quite difficult to generalize the terms that are used in HIV/AIDS. So our first step is to educate people in the church so that they would also be careful on the kind of language that they use against people who are living with HIV and AIDS, so that they don't scare them, but provide a welcoming home in the church so that they would be able to be part and parcel of the family. Because HIV/AIDS is not outside the church, it is the people. It is we pastors also burying the people that are there. We remain with their children. We remain with their wives or husbands living in our churches. So it has been more of a gradual process based on biblical teachings of providing care, giving a hand of Christ, reaching those who are sick in the community rather than disassociating from them.
Let's talk about the orphans of HIV. That is also a whole problem in and of itself. Pastor Chuchu, if you would, what can the church uniquely do there in Kenya to deal with HIV orphans?
Currently, through LCMS World Relief and Human Care, we are addressing the orphans' needs. And one of those greatest needs is education. It is not unusual to find a lady or a girl or a boy who is 14 becoming a the head of the family after losing the parents. And in such a situation, with no education at all, it's like the life and is everything is like coming to a deadlock to that person. So our primary focus has been in helping the orphans, first with education, and secondly, there are those that are so small to go to schools or have even guardians or relatives to take care of them. And we have developed a program through LCMS World Relief Support that is building up rescue centers that these girls and boys who remain as orphans in our community are taken care of in church environment, where we have these rescue centers and they're brought up in their spiritual life, and the church becomes their parents.
Dr. Oyeyo, are some of these orphans born with HIV? Are they infected at birth with HIV?
Yeah, the pediatric HIV cases, most of them are due to mother-to-child transmission. And actually, it's one of the challenges that we are having. And the government of Kenya is trying to address it through the services to empower women to be able to know when they are, to be aware when they are infected, and to take measures, which includes taking the antiretroviral drugs during pregnancy and after delivery. Now, the other challenge that we have is that in our setup, majority of pregnant women do not attend antenatal clinics. Mm. So you find a mother will go throughout the pregnancy without knowing her HIV status, and most of them still deliver at home, and they transmit the infection. So most of the children that we have are as a result of vertical transmission of HIV/AIDS.
Sally, a final question for you before we wrap up our conversation here. What's planned next? You've been there twice. You've been able to do a variety of things, kind of a clinic, open clinic situation, and then some surgeries with more open clinic. What's next on the agenda for LCMS World Belief and Medical Mercy in Kenya? You got about 1 minute here.
Okay, what we plan on doing is our goal is to have monthly trips, and not just to Kenya, but internationally.
Monthly trips.
Monthly trips. It's a big goal that's been put before us, and we don't intend to have that in 07, but it could be as possible as early as 08 or 09. Of every month, we have a team of LCMS, medical professionals, and volunteers and their friends. Like the group that went in March contacted me. They had put their own group together, and not all of them were church members, but they agreed by our, you know, to play by our rules, so to speak, and participate in worship and, you know, join us in treating the people of Kenya. And it was a very well received. And I have a group of people already that I've received emails from that are interested in attending. And we're going to get out a schedule and get more people coming. I know we'll have a trip in October, probably two trips to Kenya in October. And we're planning one for Guatemala and possibly Indonesia before the end of the year.
Well, to find out more of what LCMS World Relief is doing in Kenya and elsewhere to deal with the whole variety of problems that present themselves in each individual place, you can go to our website tonight, issuesetc.org. The logo for LCMS World Relief is right there. You can also call and donate, earmark a donation for Medical Mercy in Kenya or whatever suits your fancy. The number 1-888-930-4438. 1-888-930-4438. It's LCMS World Relief, Christ-centered, cross-focused relief efforts. Sally Henriksen is a registered nurse. She's material and medical goods resource coordinator for LCMS World Relief. Thanks for being our guest.
My pleasure, Todd.
Pastor David Chuchu is project director for the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks.
And Dr. Dayden Oyeho is a medical doctor in Kenya. Thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks a lot.
We'll be right back with the second hour of Issues, Etc.